today, our keynote speaker is Professor Dave Ray. He's Professor of Carbon Management and Assistant Principal of Global Environment and Society at the University of Edinburgh. He's worked in climate change for over 20 years, and his research has taken him from stormy seas in the Southern Ocean to evil-smelling Scottish ditches, and I hope he's going to tell us a bit more about this. He's written several popular books on climate change, and he's created an award-winning Masters of Carbon Management at Edinburgh University. Dave is also editor of the climate change science website, Greenhouse Gas Online, and he enjoys running. He enjoys test matches, and he enjoys writing stories for his daughters. Dave is in a very strong position to correct any errors I've made in the statistics in my introductory remarks, and he's going to share with us his thoughts on walking the sustainable talk, and I very much look forward to hearing this one, Dave. So shall we all give Dave a very warm welcome?
Thanks, Angus. I should mention those daughters of mine, bloody like writing stories. They like picking up coals at school and giving them to me. So if I start sounding really bummed up, it's because I am, because they've done an awesome job of giving me a coal. So my group today was this, was to give a talk on this subject in terms of walking the sustainable talk. As I said, my research or my teaching really focused is around carbon, so I hope you forgive me if occasionally quite a bit actually in the time I've got. I'll use carbon as an example for the challenge we face in terms of being more sustainable and the real, I suppose, it's a great challenge in terms of all the talk we have about cutting carbon and about what we're going to discuss in Paris, but actually putting that into practice, walking that talk is going to be something that will test all of us around the world. So to start off with, I looked at things all of you will be really familiar with in terms of the sustainability bittersweet spot. So the kind of things you think in terms of making our universities and colleges more sustainable, the kind of areas that we're already working in, so buildings, energy, stuff, so procurement, food and waste, there's so much stuff, good work going on. What I wanted to do in this talk is really focus on those three involved. So transport, because it's a real headache for us in terms of academics flying a lot. Our students come from all over the world. There's a big, certainly carbon impact from that. The students are mentioned there, but also I really want to talk about our alumni. So what we do as universities and colleges is produce amazing students who go back out into the world. They're the next generation of leaders, of actors, of stakeholders in the future climate as well. So that's going to be my three kind of focused areas. And as Angus said, in terms of the carbon dioxide, I want to bring it back to this, because this is, I hate lecturing behind the lectern, so you can tell I want to move around, but I'd like I'm going to have to point to this, so I'll try and reach. So this is my favourite figure in climate science. It's something that might look a bit dull to you, but this is the kind of thing that really gets my heart pumping. This is the Keeling curve. And this is a curve which started in 1958. Charles Keeling set up his measurement station in Mauna Loa in Hawaii and started measuring how much carbon dioxide there was in the atmosphere. So he knew we were burning lots of fossil fuel, there was carbon in that, so more carbon dioxide being emitted. He wanted to see what effect that was having. And what Keeling found was, first of all, this red pattern here, this beautiful curve where it goes up in the winter as the plants stop growing, and then you get into the spring and the summer in the northern hemisphere, and the carbon dioxide flows back into the vegetation. So a beautiful thing. But then underneath that trend, as the years went by, Keeling saw, and the world saw, the carbon dioxide concentrations were going up. Now the reason I obsess about this, I'm a real geek about this graph, is it's here that we will see the impacts or the success or failure of all of our efforts on climate change. What we need to do in terms of that black line there, which is the 5-year average, is see that stabilise, see it level out. So sometimes I get hugely excited, because you'll see what about end of 2012, it looked like it was starting to level out. I was thinking, is this it? Stabilisation. We're stabilising potentially at a safe level. But obviously we haven't seen that, we've seen continued growth. This is what the negotiations about in Paris. This is what we're all about in terms of carbon management, is stabilising that atmospheric concentration at a level which avoids dangerous climate change. So we're up, as Angus said, at about 400 parts per million at the moment. We have a safe boundary, we think, of around 450, 500 ppm maximum in terms of keeping us below dangerous climate change. So in terms of our budget, our allowance on carbon, our credit is running out. So, with that in mind, for universities and colleges, we have a bit of a challenge. We've got a constrained world in terms of resources, in terms of how much carbon we can emit, but we want bigger universities, want more staff, want more students, we want to grow, we want to increase accessibility. And obviously we probably don't want kind of lectures like that or rooms like that. But as we grow, we're experiencing, obviously, growing pains in terms of our emissions and our sustainability. So we need more estate. Certainly Edinburgh, I'm sure this is true for a lot of universities and colleges, we have more high-powered computers taking lots of electricity. And as long as that electricity requires lots of carbon to be produced, then it's unsustainable. We've got more travel because we've got this international student body, but also staff are expected to jet around the world. And all of that comes together in terms of rising emissions. So on the one hand, as institutions which are all about education and good for the world, we want to grow and increase accessibility. But on the other, in terms of keeping our practice sustainable, there's a real, real challenge there. So some things that we could consider. So this is definitely in the mind of Dave Gorman, who's in the front here in terms of the climate strategy for Edinburgh. We've been discussing this, like all universities, in terms of how we can grow more sustainably. How can we grow without contributing to that healing curve rise? One of the models that I suggested we adopt, so this is just my personal view, is the Chinese model. So China, a bit like a lot of the universities, has grown rapidly. Their emissions have grown rapidly. And for a long time, they refused to ever commit to reductions in their emissions because that wasn't didn't fit with their development trajectory. But recently, they have said, we will peak our emissions. In 2030, China as an economy will peak our emissions and will start to then reduce. It was a real landmark commitment from them, which brought a lot of other countries from the developing world with them. And this is the kind of pattern that we can see around universities, where we say, yes, we're growing, yes, in the short term, emissions probably will keep going up, but we will peak and we will reduce them. We will have a plan which takes us down the road of the Chinese. The ways we can do that, well, we've got grid intensity in the UK, which is how much carbon is emitted for every megawatt hour of electricity we get down the line. And that should go down in terms of renewables coming online and decarbonisation of our supply. The other option a lot of the universities have are the combined heat and power plants that David, I think, is going to give a tour of during this conference. Again, they can help for the university's footprint itself to reduce that, take a bite out of it. This is something I think is going to be key for Edinburgh too, is to look at other options where we can produce low carbon electricity in particular. We can mainstream reduction, so this is obviously something, again, that you'll be discussing a lot during today, is how we take things we know will work and we need to do. How do we make staff and students, the whole community, actually mainstream them, so it's not just the sustainability officer out in their drafty shed, but actually it's the heads of school, the heads of college, and all of the staff doing this as standard. And one of the solutions that I'm going to suggest now is a case study. So this is, be critical if you like, but for me, this really excites me. It's the idea that we can expand to university, we can expand using online delivery. And the idea is that we have online delivery which gets as close as possible, in some ways, to complete our online student experience. So we're growing their student numbers, but avoiding a lot of the carbon emissions, a lot of the downsides of the growth that we're looking for. So increasing accessibility with low carbon. So this is what we came up with, was an online master's in carbon management. So this was based on an on-campus version of the programme that Angus mentioned. And this was the vision, was to give global access, to give access wherever you had a mobile phone in the world. Sub-Saharan Africa, you can still take this programme. We wanted a world-class student experience, so not one which was, because it's online, it'll be a bit kind of meh, it'll be less interesting, less engaging. We wanted it to be really good. We wanted a great staff experience. We wanted, as teachers, as educators, to have just as much of an engaging experience, an enjoyable experience, as we do face to face. And what we wanted to end up with was low carbon learning about low carbon, but really hitting a win-win. So that was the vision. The URL there, you can check it out to see the kind of things we delivered. So, what didn't work? So this was now a five-year programme. So we started off with one course, put it online, to look at its carbon implications and its implications for student experience. So one thing that didn't work was having access for students all around the world at just the time that suited me. So for me, starting time on a Tuesday is really good, but for the time zones around the world, that doesn't necessarily work. So it's about accessibility, and you have to learn that. The global capacity building, which was a key aim of the programme, we had a lack of global representation, probably because of my coffee time slot, but also because of some barriers we had in place, like finances, etc. And the engagement, the experience, we couldn't just take a face-to-face lecture, record it, put it on video, and then say, just watch that, and that, and you'll get the same experience. That ended up with this kind of asleep on the laptop. So what has worked for access? How have we developed it? Well, we use a lot of face-to-face contact, but using the internet, so using Google Hangouts, and things called Collaborate, you get to know the students. It's fantastic. You actually get to know them as well as the face-to-face students. You talk about actually a lot more, because the idea is it's a flipped classroom. They go through all of the materials in their own time, but then we meet up and have great conversations. We instigated early and late slots for the different time zones to increase that accessibility, navigation videos, etc. So in terms of what's worked for access, it's been a learning curve, but it seems to be paying off now. In the global capacity building side of it, the key there for us, so there are a few barriers there, particularly on lower costs, so you can get those sub-Saharan African students onto the programme, the flexible delivery into that. But one of the key aims for us over the next year is to secure a huge number of scholarships for those students who are in countries where they just can't pay even our reduced fee for these online programmes, so that they can get that access and so we can build capacity overseas, which is ultimately what the programme's about. And in terms of engagement, so I mentioned these hangouts, I did love them because the students have gone through the content, and if we've done our job well, they kind of got it. They might have a few questions about the content. But what we talk about is the weather where they are. So we'll go around the table, as it were, because everyone's popped up on the screen, and we'll have a shivering here in Edinburgh with the rain lashing down, talk about our weather and the climate projections attached to that. And then we'll have someone in Syria saying, well, not looking out the window at the moment, it's a bit dangerous out there, and someone else in Brazil saying, oh, it's very, very hot here at the moment. And it's just, and we talk about kids and jobs, etc. It is a really a revelation to me, actually, how much engagement I can have as a member of staff talking to them and how much they seem to get out of it with us. We've instigated role-play exercises, video assignments, and these three at the bottom, particularly the cook along with carbon. This was something where I was thinking, we've got these students all over the world, and when I've got them in class, I give them bits of soil, and I give them bits of wood, and we talk about how much carbon is in them. So how can we do that online? So what we've done is send them packs of bits of wood, and so everyone got their bit of wood on screen, and we talk about it, virtually. And it's working. You can do kind of practicals through this virtual route, so that's been a success. So in terms of those aims for low carbon learning, what did we have in mind? We wanted this online substitute for student travel, so students from all over the world not jetting back and forwards to Edinburgh, so hopefully a positive from that. Obviously, for our growing estate, if we've got students who haven't got to be here, then there could be some benefits in terms of on-campus efficiency. We don't have to have bigger and more lecture theatres. So one of the things we've done with this programme is quantify what the net benefits are. And we think we might have got the greenest master set. We've been using it in terms of marketing. So we estimated the carbon footprint of the course and worked out that per year, so students take this over 3 years, it's 35 kilograms of CO2. So this is based on the electricity that the computers they're using. We make an assumption based on the country they're in and the grid emission factor and the servers that are running the online program here and the Spark computing time. So it's pretty low. So with 40 students on this course, it's the equivalent of one return flight from London to Los Angeles. So something that my on-campus students would do on a regular basis. And then we went a further step. One of my graduates runs this Plan Rebo, which is an organisation which does, as part of its work, poverty alleviation through carbon management in the developing world, and they sell carbon offsets. So we think we've got as much as we can make it a carbon neutral program. So where do we go from there? So we had success in terms of the student experience. We thought we had something which was lower carbon and was ticking the boxes in terms of us and the students. And we got talking about making it bigger, because ever, if you've got a success, you want to do more of it. And so we looked at the whole of the institution in terms of Edinburgh and what our graduates leave the university with. So the carbon management masters, they obviously got interested in climate change, that's what they would leave their career. But actually, for the tens of thousands of students in this institution, we thought it would be good to give everyone opportunity, whether they're going to be a medic, they're going to be a banker, they're going to be a lawyer, an opportunity to learn about sustainability and then reflect on that and hopefully through their lives as an Edinburgh graduate, implement some of our sustainability thinking. And we thought online could do it. Because we have such an issue with timetabling and lots of different degree programmes not overlapping. So online we approved could work, and so we went for this online sustainability course which we're developing now. So new lecture theatres, more computing, more accessibility. This is the vision that I just outlined to give every student the opportunity to get this multidisciplinary approach. I mean, the strength of the fact that we've got a lawyer and a banker and a medic to talk about the wicked problems of sustainability, so climate change, food, water, energy security, because all of these things can't be solved just by one discipline. Actually, the students are the answer to these wicked issues. We wanted, again, a world-class online learning experience. And one of the visions for this, which I hope we're going to deliver, is integration of that online experience with the on-campus students and with the alumni community, giving them access to the course too, bringing them in as tutors and students, and actually making this a global course rather than just an Edinburgh course. So I mentioned the sustainability goals of these different disciplines having familiarity with sustainability. One of the key aims of this is to develop open loop learners. So for the institution to be more sustainable, by us not just being a 4-year experience for our students, but actually us being a lifelong institution. So they study here, yes, for their degree, but they take an online course, they have a great experience. But 10 years down the line, they want to retrain, they want to maybe change career or slightly upskill. They come back to Edinburgh virtually, they're busy, they've got kids, they've got full-time jobs. Ultimately, what we want is this global community which delivers positive impact. So every graduate of Edinburgh doing good for the world. We think of ourselves as a great university in terms of research, and we are, and we do good through that. In terms of policy advice, again, we do good through that. But for me, our most powerful, our most positive method, vector for good in the world is through our students, through our graduates. And that brings me to what's happening the end of this month, the beginning of December in Paris. And an exemplar of that for me. So for the Paris Conference of the Parties, the COP, we're sending a delegation from Edinburgh, and we did the same for Copenhagen. Copenhagen for us was brilliant, it was awful for everyone else. We had a great day in terms of our students representing us. So we're taking this route again, but this time we put a call out for our alums, particularly from the Carbon Management Programme, to say who else is going. There's about 250 of them around the world. And there's a large number of our alums going. They outnumber us at the Conference of the Parties. And you'll see, so Rebecca is a current student, but she's very busy in various other institutions as a representative for them in Paris. But Thomas and Stefan got back to me. Thomas said, oh yeah, I'll be there. I'm actually advising the French presidency for the climate conference. This is one of our alums. I was kind of, oh my God, we need to capture that, because that's a brilliant positive contribution of our alumni. Stefan got back and said, yeah, I'm on the negotiation team for Germany. And so we've got this amazing story, which hopefully you'll see as part of our package we'll put together for Edinburgh's contribution to the COP. But for me, in terms of walking the sustainable talk, we can do loads on campus, and it's absolutely crucial for staff to get involved in that. But ultimately, walking the sustainable talk for us as a university, I think for all universities and colleges, is going to be through our students. They are really the ones who will deliver.
Discussion of kind of internal conflict, I guess, with the students who are on your course. Because they're clearly people that have chosen to be online course, so they've thought about their impact and what they're doing. And I'm just wondering how much depth you go into those kinds of internal conflicts inside flights, or like, curious as to what's the most common themes.
Yeah, so the online students tend to be about campus students. This is for the master's program. And they're all doing it because they're at full-time jobs. They're frightening to teach because they know so much. So they pop up and they look through your content, so it's not like you can deliver like a lecture and go, oh, you know, I'm the expert, I'm giving you, they've done all that, and they pop up online and say, you know, so in terms of political instability in the Middle East, what's your view, Dave, in terms of climate change and fraud? And you kind of go, well, right, they can tell me, because they're, you know, some of them are actually working in the Middle East on exactly that. So it's a real, I'm loving it because I'm learning so much from them. But they're a different type of student because they're wanting, in every case of the ones who are doing it, maybe we've got a dozen on this online programme, they want the course to extend their current expertise. So it's not like they're going to get a job in climate change through the programme because they're already working on building development or climate change. They want some extra skills, and that's the main difference. So some of them are full-time carers as well, but all of them, you know, they're students who would never come to Edinburgh. And that's the beauty of it, is that we're giving access to students who would never be here otherwise.
Hi, it's Daniel O'Connor from Warbit. We're an online news platform, and our business is completely virtual. It doesn't exist. It just lives in the cloud. And we use webinars to sell our product to Australia, for example. But we have technical and behavioural problems with acceptance of webinars on Google Hangouts. AAC is really good at doing webinars. But have you got any tips or advice to get staff used to using webinars as part of their work life, technical and behavioural?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I suppose I need to reflect on why I've become happy with them because I use them a lot. I suppose a lot of us use Skype now, so that's a nice way in to have a small kind of group Skype. What we had to do with our students to get them engaged with it was to have, just like it would be on campus, have quite a thorough induction week. So the first time we ran these courses, it was a disaster. So we had, I was sitting there waiting for more to pop up, and no one popped up. I could see my face, I could see some colleagues, and then emails started coming in going, I can't get on, and how do I do it? So the first week was, you know, basically just trying to sort out the tech. The tech kind of worked, but a lot of it isn't as intuitive as it might be. So what we put in place was quite a lot of training and an induction week, which was all about making sure everyone can access at different band speeds and things like that. So we had to change the instructions to take the bandwidth as well, on with audio rather than video. And it was really, I think with all of them, they got a bit of it, so they'd all, I think everyone had used Skype, so it wasn't completely new. But it was a little bit of hand-holding, and you know, I was exactly the same in terms of how to use the technology. I think once they're into it, which they are now, they never gave back. So it is difficult, I absolutely agree, and certainly in certain parts of the world the internet connections aren't great. There's also a culture we found from when we're marketing this programme. For North America, lots of students get the online learning idea and count it as an equal master's. There's some resistance in England, we found, because employers traditionally have seen the online kind of qualification as not being comparable to on campus. So that there are still issues there, absolutely. But I think in terms of technology, it's finding out where they're based. If they use the internet, that's good. And then if they use Skype or something like it, even better. And then helping them through into the other platforms that are delivery methods that you're using.
Thank you for your talk. I'm Katerina from University of Strathclyde. I think it's an amazing project that you started. The masters, and then not only the masters, but that it evolved into also online training for the all the members of the university. So I would like to know what training is being done in that online platform for not the masters, but the online platform. Is it only carbon? Or when you say sustainability, what areas are you covering?
Yeah, so I should have explained that a bit more. So this course is for a first year undergraduate level, so it's level 8 in Scotland. And the idea is that it's available to every student in the university. So it covers what is sustainability and social responsibility. So the presumption is that students can come from any of our 20 odd schools and universities or any background, and it's not. It's going to give them more of an opportunity to discuss what they think sustainability is, reflect on their discipline and how that can be applied as a solution, and to hopefully plant a seed in that first year, but then they can improve their studies, whatever program they follow, and out into the world once they graduate. So the idea is that this will, we're starting it next year, we'll run for the first time in Anglia, and the idea is that we'll have hundreds and tens of thousands of students on this. But, so whenever I tell my bosses that, they kind of, their eyes light up, so they think, oh, this is going to be a really efficient way to put students through. Or they go, oh my god, you know, how on earth would you make students feel like this is a good course with that many? But the way the students will see it is they'll all be part of 20 student teams through by a trained tutor who takes them through the course. So actually, compared to their normal undergraduate lectures,
to give your thoughts on carrots and sticks, and the big question, how do you see the outcome of the negotiations coming up in Paris?
Okay, so carrots and sticks for nations, the big stick is the fact that climate change, if we go above 2 degrees of post-industrial warming, so into the dangerous zone when heat maps can kick in, no nation is safe. I think all nations recognise that you know, you can have some short-term gains in terms of warming and say, well, you know, things aren't too bad for us in terms of our health system secure, that kind of thing. But as climate change gets very severe, the impacts get more and more severe because we have a global economy and so well connected, we will all have negative consequences. So that's the kind of the stick, certainly for second half of this century. That's got to be in the mind. The big carrot, I think, for Paris is that we still have that window. So that latitude in terms of how much carbon we can emit, there's an opportunity there to decarbonise our economies, to avoid the dangerous climate change, and do that in a way which isn't only good in terms of carbon emissions, but actually helps in terms of air quality. Lots of co-benefits can be identified. So the economic analysis, which is one of the things my students look at a lot, is all about the benefits in terms of tackling climate change now, because it costs you so much later on. So there's a big carrot there. But again, it's all about that intergenerational. You need to look over time. Sometimes politics doesn't work. I think in terms of the economics of Paris, it's already a roller coaster. The Copenhagen was a roller coaster during it. This one's been a roller coaster since June. Into the draft agreement's been redrafted loads of times, and the text has come down, but it's still full of options, and it doesn't look great in terms of, I'm a real optimist, I really am, but even with my most optimistic hat on, there is no way Paris will deliver an agreement which by itself will avoid 2 degrees of post-industrial warming, based on what we know about climate sensitivity. It will get us somewhere towards it, maybe something like 3 degrees of post-industrial warming, if all the contributions which nations say they're going to make come to fruition. The big thing I'm looking for in Paris is it not to be the end. So one of the major negotiations, the sticking point, is going to be stocktaking. This is where scientists are going to come into it. Is stocktaking saying, okay, as a nation, industrialised nation, you haven't made a very good contribution in terms of your emission cuts based on scientific evidence. We're going to reassess you independently, and because that doesn't fit with where we need to be as a global society tackling climate change, you need to make more aggressive cuts in your emissions. If that mechanism comes out of Paris, that will be a triumph. And although it's at the moment wrapped up in legalese called stock taking and who would do it, actually that's, for me, one of the great things we could see delivered.
Dave, you've given us some really interesting food for thought there in terms of credit running out. A real insight into a challenging question for companies, for organisations, and for a country's economy. How do you grow without contributing to that increase in carbon dioxide emissions? And then a solution in terms of the context he was working in. I thought impressed me was that you could work out the carbon footprint